Last week, I shared with you the beginning of part two of this discussion on the Constitution. Today, you should have a brand new outline that is the second half of that. We ended by covering the preamble. So we will we'll go beyond that. But I wanted to discuss for just a moment why I believe that it's appropriate to do a study like this at church. I know that there are many, probably not so many here, but there are some maybe who are watching online or who will see this later who think, well, man, I thought they taught the Bible there. Well, we do. And remember, we just finished an entire journey through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and we'll get back to a study here very, very soon. But the believer living in a representative republic needs to know how their republic functions, because since there have been so few of those in history, and they're very rare, very fragile, we have to guard them or we lose them. We just simply lose them. Never in the history of man have people enjoyed the kind of freedom, especially when it comes to religious freedom, that we do. This is kind of an unprecedented moment in history. It's often called an experiment, and it really, really is, because most people have never been able to experience the kind of religious liberty, freedom of speech, and all these other freedoms that we enjoy. Now, those are gifts from God, not government, but our founders and framers were wise enough to do their very best to protect those unalienable rights by our founding documents and principles. And one of those documents, of course, is the Constitution. As I've said before, I believe greater emphasis should be placed on the Declaration of Independence, because it's kind of the Bible from which the Constitution springs. But it's still important that we understand the Constitution. What are you looking for? Could that be it right there? I did not steal it. Emmett Clark stole this. Actually, somebody picked it up in the parking lot, and so I just saw him. Yeah, but I've been praying about it. I mean, you know. Anyhow, we have the Constitution. It's very important that we understand what especially was there originally, because the Constitution is under attack both from without and within, unfortunately. And we need to understand these documents. Very, very important, because if we lose this republic, we're going to lose this religious liberty that we have been so privileged to enjoy. And of course, we're going to then be faced with what so many people in history have been faced with, and have to go underground and fight for our faith. And that's unnecessary if we understand the principles that undergird what eventually produces the U.S. Constitution. Now, I've mentioned this quote before. I'm not sure that I've given it to you, but Abraham Lincoln was criticized strongly early in his presidential run and in his political career for wanting to talk about slavery as an issue and in different places. And he was so criticized that he eventually responded to the criticism on March the 6th, 1860. Now, I want you to listen to what he said. He said, "We must not call it," and he's referring to what people are saying to him. He's referring to slavery here. "We must not call it wrong in politics, because that is bringing morality into politics. And we must not call it wrong in the pulpit, because that is bringing politics into religion. We must not bring it into the tract society." Now, that's what we would call evangelistic ministries. In those days, they called them tract societies, because they'd pass out Bible tracts. Or the other societies, he's talking about religious, Christian, because those are such unsuitable places. "And there is no single place, according to you, where this wrong thing can be properly called wrong." Now, I think that quote is important because it points out a problem in our dilemma. They tell us, well, you're not supposed to talk religion in political circles, because that's bringing religion into politics. And you're not supposed to talk about political issues in church, because that's bringing politics into religion. So the question then rebounds, well, where can we talk about these things? Parking lots? in little enclaves, hiding out somewhere in the woods. No, of course not. We need to talk about these things in open gatherings. And I can't imagine a better place to understand the Christian influence of our founding documents than at church. Now, certainly we don't want just a steady diet of history, but when it comes to our republic and our religious liberties and understanding as believers how we need to respond to these documents and how we need to work to protect them and the ideas that they enshrine, I think it's very important that we learn these things at church. In fact, I'm convinced that since these things have not been taught at church, people don't know them. They just simply don't know these things. And because of it, of course, our liberties are in great jeopardy today. So last week we talked about how the Constitution establishes a form of government that we live under called federalism. Now federalism is where two different authorities govern the same people in the same area. So you have a federal and a state government here in the states. And each one has a range of jurisdiction. And as long as they stay within their area of jurisdiction, everything works perfectly. So when you talk about our having a federal government, what that's a reference to is our form of government is a form called federalism, where you have the federal government and then you have the state governments. Unfortunately, we've lost the understanding of this word. We've lost the understanding of what federalism is and how it operates. And so today, you have the federal government usurping all of the authority and basically steamrolling the states. So what has ended up happening is you have these influencers that get into Washington, D.C. quite often from the left, and they dominate the political scene in Washington, D.C., and then there's a one-size-fits-all decree or law that is set out across the states that is not congruent with the different cultures in the different 50 states. You see, our founders and framers envisioned a union of independent sovereign states where all of the cultural distinctives would be kept separate from the other states, and then you would be free to move about to the state that best embraced the principles you believe. They did not see this one-size-fits-all coming from Washington, D.C. So today, of course, the Supreme Court usurps authority over the other two branches. And so when the Supreme Court says marriage can be anything we want it to be, then they force that on all 50 states. In 1973, when Roe v. Wade came down for the Supreme Court, and it's now legal to murder a preborn child, they forced it on all 50 states. Even though there's a large swath of states that believe it's murder and have been working, trying to get out from under this evil decree. But when you lose the understanding and the functionality of a federal kind of government, where you have two different powers governing the same peoples in the same area with different areas of jurisdiction, and you blur the lines, then you have the mess that we're dealing with today. So this is why these things are so important. Now, we ended up last week in looking at the preamble of the Constitution. The reason why the preamble is so important is because it's much like an introduction to a book, an introduction to a speech, an introduction to a sermon. It sets the table for what is about to come. And so in the preamble, we looked at all of the different points that were emphasized. Unfortunately, most people are not all that familiar with the preamble. Now, we'll hear phrases that we recognize, like we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. But immediately we've lost it and we say nation and we lose the idea it's a union of states. Ultimately, 50 free independent states. That's never changed legally. Now, it's argued back and forth that Amendments 13, 14, and 15 did away with state sovereignty. Well, if it did, then why do we still have states? I mean, if the states are nothing more than rubber stamps for the federal government, wouldn't we be a lot better off to abolish all the state governments, call them federal districts? Get away from having state legislatures and governors and all that. We save tons and tons of money if Oklahoma is just the federal district of Oklahoma. Obviously, it's not. We have a state constitution. We have official state borders. We have an official chief executive called a governor. We have a state legislature, bicameral, just like in Congress in Washington, D.C. We have state agencies. We have a state judiciary. There's a reason why all of the states have these things. But they're just simple redundancies today based upon our lack of knowledge of how it's supposed to operate. So the preamble gives us a very important introduction to many, many things. Now, what I want to do today then is go into the body of the Constitution, knowing that we're just scratching the surface. Please understand this. This is not a thorough, exhaustive study of the Constitution, but kind of from a 30,000-foot view, let's just look at the Constitution from high altitude and get some clear understanding about it. The Constitution is made up of seven articles, and I think it's very important that we remember what all of the articles are about. Article 1 establishes the legislative branch using 10 sections. That's going to be important in just a moment. Article 2 establishes the executive branch. Of course, legislative would be Congress. Executive is the presidency, the president's administration. Notice four sections to establish that branch. And then Article 3 establishes the judicial branch using three sections. It also only establishes the Supreme Court. It leaves it up to Congress to establish all the other federal courts that would be necessary. And unfortunately, today, we have such a juggernaut of federal courts that that's where all of the usurpation initially takes place. And then they finally send on up to the Supreme Court all these silly, frivolous arguments. And then the Supreme Court gives these edicts from Washington, D.C., and they take all of this massive power upon them. Well, notice the emphasis that the framers placed on the different branches. It's obvious the one they thought was most important. By the area of explanation and regulation, it would be the legislative branch. It's the most responsive to the people, and therefore they use 10 sections to describe it and explain it. Notice the one they considered the least important, the judicial. They only used three sections. In fact, until 1935, there was a visible reminder of the lower importance that the framers placed on the Supreme Court by where they met. Did you know that until 1935, the Supreme Court met in the basement of the Capitol? They met under the House of Representatives and the Senate. Now, there's a reason for that. They believed the judiciary, even though they're three co-equal branches, was not nearly as responsive to the people and therefore should not receive all of the emphasis that the legislative branch did, and they met in the basement. It wasn't until the early 30s that they start building a Supreme Court building, and then you have that huge edifice that's basically a temple today, and you have the Supreme Court now that's out on its own rogue and has become incredibly problematic that we could say a lot more about. Article 4 talks about states' relations, how the states are going to relate to one another and to the federal government. Article 5 describes how you amend the Constitution. There's two ways, Congress or the states. Whoever suggests amendments, it takes three-fourths of the states to ratify any amendment, whatever it is. This is where you have the very common discussion today of an Article 5 convention. It comes out of Article 5, where Article 5 empowers the states to come together in a called convention to amend the Constitution. Now, by the way, I do want to clear up something here. There is no provision in the Constitution to have a constitutional convention and undo the Constitution. An Article 5 convention, by definition, is an amendment convention. Now, many people have been concerned that if we ever did have one of those, that the convention would go runaway rogue and would trash the Constitution and write something new. The argument is that's what they did with the Articles of Confederation at the first Constitutional Convention. So there's an argument back and forth between two normally very conservative groups. One conservative group led by guys like Mark Levin and others who believe that an Article 5 convention is not only constitutional, but is necessary, and he's been calling for one for years. And then you have other groups who say, no. We can't trust the kind of leadership we have today, and it would be a runaway convention, and they would trash the Constitution. Well, regardless of where you stand on that, I'm kind of in the position where I say, you know what, if we're incapable of self-governance, I'd like to know it sooner than later. I mean, if we can no longer function as a union of states and the Constitution is so weak that it could be easily trashed, might as well just fight that out pretty soon. In fact, I've told my wife, if this thing's going to devolve into some kind of war, this culture war that we see now, if it's going to break out into a literal war, I hope it comes sooner rather than later while I'm still young enough to fight so my grandkids don't have to. Now, that's pretty cryptic talk, and I understand that, and I'm certainly not hoping for any kind of a war. I'm just simply telling you. But that's where the argument comes from. That's why it's called an Article 5 convention, and probably many of you in this room are on different sides of that debate, and that's fine. That's a good, healthy debate, and we could talk more about that, but that's not the purpose of this morning. And then Article 6 deals with debts, national supremacy, and oaths of office. There's a real issue there in this national supremacy that we'll come back to. And then Article 7 talks about how you ratify any amendments to the Constitution. Of course, there's a three-fourths requirement. That's not as high of a threshold as the Articles of Confederation had because it took unanimous vote to amend the Articles of Confederation. But still, 75% is a pretty high bar. It's typically very difficult to get three-fourths of the states to ratify something. So it's still a pretty high bar. That's basically the Constitution. It's amazing, actually, when you look at it, how short the U.S. Constitution really is. If you compare the U.S. Constitution to the Oklahoma Constitution, I don't know how much you've ever read of the Oklahoma Constitution. It's a book about that thick. It's unbelievable. In fact, there's so much there that by the time you read through it, you get toward the end, you forget was at the first. And there's a lot of contradictory doublespeak in the Oklahoma Constitution because it's just so lengthy. And I have found that the more words you give legislators and attorneys, the more they can twist them and do bad things with them. So the U.S. Constitution is relatively short. Now, Article 1, Section 8 is where we're having a lot of our problems today. So I want to take a look at Article 1, Section 8, and let's step through it, because in Article 1, the framers, and remember, I separate the framers, being, you know, James Madison, George Washington, those guys, Jefferson, from the founders, which I believe started around 1620 with the Pilgrims. So there's kind of 100 years separation, give or take, between, in my mind, the founders and the framers. Now, if you call them all founding fathers, that's fine. But I just want you to know the term that I'm using, understand what I'm saying. The framers, to me, are the generation that wrote the Declaration and the Constitution. They also fought the War of Independence. So if that'll help you in understanding what I'm saying here. Okay, so enumerated powers. What they wanted to do in the Constitution is list the things that the federal government could do. Now, remember something, and I don't have time this morning to go into all of it, but the federal government did not create the state governments. They already existed. The federal government was created by the states. That is very important because in the day in which we live, if you flew in here from Mars and you didn't know our history and you looked at how we operate, you would say, well, must be the federal government created these 50 states to make it easier for them to govern the whole country. It's the opposite of that. You start with 13 colonies that become the initial 13 states, and then as America grows and presses westward, you have all of these new states coming around. But the federal government did not exist first. In fact, though I'm not a big fan of Alexander Hamilton, he actually calls the federal government the creature made by the states. Unfortunately, like the story of Frankenstein, the creature is now trying to kill its creator. Because the creature we've made has become a monster, and now it's trying to destroy the states that created it. But it's very important that we understand. So, the people in those days were very concerned about a runaway central government. Now, we call it federal government, but central government. They were very fearful. Why would they be so fearful of that? Well, they had just fought an 8-year war from 75 to 83 to overthrow a central government that had all of the power. And the people had no power other than what that benevolent central government would bequeath to them. So this is why when Jefferson and his committee members wrote that our gifts are unalienable from God, that was such a revolutionary thought, because see, kings ruled by divine right. They believed they had the power from God. And now here's this revolutionary thought, not necessarily the first time it's ever occurred, but a revolutionary thought in North America that God gives the rights directly to the people. And then Jefferson says the people then form government to protect their rights. And then that government answers to the people. So they're very, very concerned about this new central government. So they begin to give this government enumerated powers. Now, obviously, we don't have the time nor really need to go through all of these, because some of them are just so straightforward that it doesn't take a whole lot of explanation. Like, for instance, here, power to punish counterfeiters if they were counterfeiting money. Power to create copyrights and patents, which, of course, is the Patent Copyright Office. There are certain things there that are not so much explanation needed, but we're going to come back to a couple of them. So don't worry about reading through all of those. And then you go to the next part of the list that goes from number 10 to number 18. Because they're actually, depending on how you count them, but I think this is probably a good way to count them, there are 18 enumerated powers. So there's the second part of the list. So they have the power to create a navy. They have a power to regulate land and naval forces, power to call out the militia, all of these different things that seem to make quite a bit of sense. Then you get down here to number 18, and though you wouldn't think it by just reading through it briefly, that's not the actual wording of it. That's just a kind of a summary statement. But this phrase necessary and proper becomes a loophole through which all kinds of evil has been perpetrated. So those are the 18 enumerated powers, of course, without going through all of them bit by bit. Now I want to take two of them, and I want to talk about two of them. The first one I want to talk about is number one, the first enumerated power. This is a power that the Articles of Confederation did not give the central government. This is one of the reasons why at the Constitutional Convention, in fact, I'm convinced why it was called to begin with, is there were many across the colonies who believed that they needed to create a stronger central government and to give that government the power to tax, because many of the states were not owning up to the agreements that they had made to help retire the war debts from the War of Independence. They were breaking off, kind of going rogue. Many of them were actually passing laws that said they absolved themselves of any debt or responsibility. Well, that was wrong. They shouldn't have done that. But they were doing that. So the ones who were really interested in creating a strong central government had a reason for thinking that. They were afraid the Union was going to come apart. And then, as I've mentioned before, the states would become so independent that the Union would no longer exist, and then Great Britain would just sail across the Atlantic and come over here and start taking states one by one and lose in reverse what they'd just won through 8 years of conflict. So it's a legitimate concern that they had. But here's the problem. When they gave Congress the power to lay and collect taxes, no one even then, even if there were people there that were somewhat nefarious at the convention, would have imagined that that power to tax could be so expanded to include anything that they wanted it to. Now, let me explain to you how they have blown it up. Look at this phrase, general welfare. Now, most of us, when we hear the statement general welfare, we would be thinking about an atmosphere of common good that is beneficial to everyone so that all of us can reach our full potential, right? That's what they meant. But today, when you hear welfare, what comes to your mind immediately? A welfare check. A welfare check. Well, that is not what the framers intended. They didn't intend for people to be living off of and finding their sustenance on the government dole. But that's what general welfare is now understood to be. And if you were to ask anybody probably younger than 40 what general welfare means, they'd say, well, it's the job of the government to make sure that everybody has a house and something to eat and a car to drive. And so we offer welfare. Well, that's not even what that phrase meant. So you understand how it's been misconstrued. Now let me show you how it's really been misconstrued. Whenever the Supreme Court was deliberating on Obamacare, trying to determine whether or not the federal government had the power to force you and me to buy health insurance, they had a problem. Because the attorneys for the federal government in favor of Obamacare had argued over and over and over that not doing this would levy a penalty on the citizens, like a fine. Okay? Well, nowhere in here do they have the enumerated power to levy fines and penalties. But they do have the power to tax. So what Chief Justice John Roberts, who we all had hoped would be a great Chief Justice, he's turned out to be the modern day Kennedy, and I'm talking about the Kennedy on the Supreme Court, who flip-flops back and forth and typically falls to the left, reworded what the federal government had been arguing. Instead of it being a penalty, he called it a tax. Now, why do you think he called it a tax? Because the federal government has the power to do that by the Constitution. So he simply, out of thin air, calls Obamacare a tax. Now it places it under enumerated power number one. Now they can force it on you constitutionally, and he was a swing vote, and that's what happened. Now later on, Congress was poised to do away with Obamacare, and John McCain was the swing vote there. And so we still have Obamacare. Now here's the problem. The problem is, using the same thinking of John Roberts, imagine this scenario. We have climate change, which is a problem. And we believe that it's caused by fossil burning fuels, or burning fossil fuels. So, we believe everybody needs to drive a Prius. But we don't have the constitutional right to force you to buy a Prius. But if we could argue that by protecting the environment, we're protecting the general welfare, then we could say, you know what? We're just going to call it a tax. We're going to call it a Prius tax. And everybody has to drive a Prius based upon the fact that the federal government is going to tax us to protect the environment. That falls within the enumerated powers. They could do the same thing. I've argued that the same thinking by which mayors and governors, but it's mostly mayors, are forcing face masks on people could be used to force a football helmet on you, or rubber flippers, or a suit of armor, or goggles. Exactly. Anything. By the same, because we're doing it to protect you, and we have the authority to do that. The same line of reasoning would lead you there instead of to a mask. So this has been greatly misused over the years. It should have been tied down more directly. Somehow there should have been more regulation. So this is how this has been misused, and we've stood by and let it happen. All right, now we go to number 18, the 18th enumerated power, which is really, it's an enumerated power, but it's basically a power in reference to the previous 17. Now here's what it actually says. That Congress has the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. That would mean the previous 17, right? And all other powers vested by this Constitution. Now, this all other powers vested by this Constitution has become problematic. Because they've expanded the Constitution to take in things that the framers wouldn't have ever intended. For instance, what do you think the framers would have said to the idea of a woman having the right to so control her body that she can murder her preborn child? You think the framers would have said, that's right, that's a constitutional right? No, of course not. Unfortunately, though, because we've decided that the Supreme Court is supreme, and they've said that's a constitutional right, right here in number 18, they would then say that we have the power to enforce abortion by powers vested by this Constitution, based upon the fact that the Supreme Court has said abortion is constitutional. Now, that was never in the original intent, but that's how the Constitution is being used today. And then it goes on to say, in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Now, here's the phrase. I have it highlighted here. Necessary and proper. It's called today the necessary and proper clause. Now, does that appear to be a clause to you? Not at all. Do you know what the necessary and proper clause is interpreted to mean today? That the federal government has the power to do whatever it deems necessary and proper to protect you. Whatever that is. Now, is that what number 18 actually says? No, number 18 says that they have the power to do what is necessary and proper to enforce the previous 17 enumerated powers. By the way, why do you think those powers are enumerated? Anybody want to take a shot at that? They're limited. There's 17 if we argue at the most 18. That's it. But unfortunately, if you're willing to read into the white part instead of the black printed part, then there's a limitless number of enumerated powers. And that is what has happened. Remember at our very beginning of our discussion a few weeks ago, we repeated what Bill Federer says when he says that power always seeks to consolidate itself. Men with a fallen heart want to consolidate power. And that's what's been going on for over 200 years. The very phrases and wording of the Constitution taken out of its historical context have been used against us. And that's why people were so afraid of this new federal government. Now, in Section 9, there are some powers denied to Congress. And they're listed here, no regulation of slavery until 1808. The reason that is there is to keep the southern states in. That's the only reason it's there. By the way, they never could have envisioned the Eli Whitney invention of the cotton gin and the explosion of the cotton industry. They believed that slavery was on its way out, and by 1808, they could do away with it. That was their intent. So before we're too quick to jump on the framers, the founders, let's remember. So there were, in the end, eight powers denied to Congress. And it's important that you notice number four. No income tax. Of course, the 16th Amendment reversed that. You remember when I told you that, in my opinion, a good number of our amendments have actually hurt the Constitution, not helped it? The 16th Amendment is a prime example. You know, one of the planks in the communist strategy is a graduated income tax. This is why the framers initially said, no income tax. You cannot tax an individual's income. Now, notice how we told the framers, thank you very much, but you're stupid. And so we wrote the 16th Amendment and reversed them 180 degrees. Do you see why when people ask me, Dan, don't you think we ought to get back to the Constitution? I always ask them, which one? Is it the one where they couldn't tax your income? Or is it the one where they can? See, it's very important because now the Constitution we live by doesn't function the way the original was intended. And then on top of it, they've done the withholding so that you really don't ever feel it. You'll hear people talk today, if they're talking about their job or getting a new job, they just want to know what their take home is. What might take home be? Imagine how different it would be if rather than your money being withheld and sent to the federal government, you had to write a check every week or every month to the federal government. You think that would change people's attitude about income tax? Of course it would. So what they said is, look, we'll help you guys. You don't have to keep up with the bookwork. We'll just withhold your taxes for you. They weren't being benevolent when they did that. They were doing that to deceive us because we don't feel it. So notice, it's just very, to me, very important that the framers understood the need to not tax income, and yet with the 16th Amendment, we completely reversed that. All right, let's look at Article 3, Section 1, because I believe this has also become problematic. When you get to Article 3, we're talking about the Supreme Court, remember? Three sections. Here's the first section. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress may form from time to time and ordain and establish. So notice it's only establishing the Supreme Court. And by the way, notice they didn't capitalize supreme. They didn't see it as the highest of the three branches. It would just be the highest court. That's all it was going to be. It was going to deal with issues like disputes between the states, disputes between a state and the federal government, tariff disputes, treaty disputes. That's primarily what the Supreme Court was going to be dealing with, at least in the intent originally of the framers. Unfortunately, that's not the case. The judges, both of the supreme and the inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior. That is a problem, because that's a lifetime appointment. And we all know that even though they can be impeached, it seldom ever happens. And in our day, I don't think you could do it. With the media as bent leftward as it is, I'm not sure that you could get rid of a Supreme Court justice, because there's a number of them we should have gotten rid of already. Not because they disagree with me. They've simply violated many of their oaths. But this lifetime appointment is a huge problem. So once you get into the Supreme Court, it's practically impossible to get rid of you. It's just like tenure universities. Same deal. The reason professors are so interested in having tenure is then they're unleashed. They can do whatever they want to do. Now, that's okay if people are good. But since people are not intrinsically good, that's a bad, bad idea. Article 3, Section 2 is another problem for me. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. Well, initially, that probably wouldn't have been such a bad thing. But unfortunately, today, with all of the expansion of federal power, that basically puts everything under the control of the Supreme Court. See, it extends to all cases falling under the Constitution. Well, today, health care is constitutional. Government health care. Today, redefining marriage to be whatever they want it to be is constitutional. Today, murdering your preborn child is constitutional. Now, those are three areas in which the framers would have been appalled if you had ever suggested to them that the federal courts would have the power over those things. And yet, that's where we are, and that's why this is so problematic. Article 4. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land. Well, that would tend to make sense, except what if those federal laws take precedence over state laws? What does that do to state sovereignty? It puts it beneath federal sovereignty. Now, that's probably not what the framers intended, but think about it. Everything that is passed by the United States under the Constitution is now the supreme law of the land, according to Article 4. Do you see why we're in such a mess and a juggernaut today? And why we find it so difficult now to extricate ourselves? Now, I'm not a huge Abraham Lincoln fan. I'm split right down the middle on him. But I often give some quotes from him because he got some things right. And here's one of the things that he got right. He was talking about the Supreme Court and its power over particular issues. And I want you to listen to this quote. I know it's a little bit lengthy, but you need to listen to it and read it with me. He said, "I do not forget the position assumed by some that constitutional questions are to be decided by the Supreme Court. Nor do I deny that such decisions must be binding in any case upon the parties to a suit as to the object of that suit." That's very important. We're going to be thinking about that. "While they are also entitled to very high respect and consideration in all parallel cases by all other departments of the government. And while it is obviously possible that such decision may be erroneous in any given case, still the evil effect following it being limited to that particular case." Notice he says that again. "With the chance that it may be overruled and never become a precedent for other cases." How do the courts operate today? Case law, precedent, or what is called stare decisis. Even our conservative Supreme Court justices have embraced that concept. Antonin Scalia basically said that even though the incorporation doctrine can't be found in the 14th Amendment, the courts have said it's there, so we must believe that it's there even if it isn't there. I'm not kidding you. That's what he said. Lincoln goes on to say, the chance that it may be overruled and never become a precedent for other cases can better be borne than could be evils of a different practice. At the same time, the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by decisions of the Supreme Court, the instant they are made in ordinary litigation between parties in personal actions, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. And I meant to put that in yellow. Notice that phrase, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. Having to that extent practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal. Nor is there in this view any assault upon the court or the judges. It is a duty from which they may not shrink to decide cases properly brought before them, and it is no fault of theirs if others seek to turn their decisions to political purposes. So to paraphrase, what Lincoln is saying is, yes, the Supreme Court decides eventually on constitutional issues, but it's only their decision is only reserved to that case. And if that's not true, and their decisions are irrevocable, then the citizens have lost their ability to govern themselves. Wasn't he prophetic? It's prophetic. This is exactly what has happened to us today. This is why I argue that we need to be better students of the Declaration. Because we're going to have to make our arguments from the Declaration. The courts have assumed upon themselves ultimate power to define what the Constitution means. And so they tell us what they believe it means, and we're stuck. And what Lincoln was talking about has now happened. Well, once you move through the Constitution, you come to the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. The fear was so great in this federal government that most of the states said, we're not going to ratify this thing. It's a monster. In fact, Patrick Henry nearly defeated the ratification in Virginia. And had he been successful, the Constitution would have gone back to the drawing board. But the Federalists, who are actually the big central government guys, said, well, look, if you'll ratify this Constitution, we'll put together a bunch of amendments that list the negative powers of government, meaning the things it can't do. There were 12 original amendments. 10 were ratified by the states, and they become the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution. We call them the Bill of Rights. It lists what the government can't do. Now, it's very interesting, if you read the preamble, it says, the conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. Now, that's a little bit wordy, but if you'll just focus on a couple of phrases, you'll get what they were saying. They were concerned that the Constitution was going to allow the federal government to misconstrue and abuse its powers. And so they wanted to have declarations and restrictive clauses added so that the federal government couldn't do that. And the fact that they capitalized government here, they're talking about the federal government. So the preamble to the Bill of Rights is written to limit which government, state governments or federal government? Federal government. Now then, I hear the bell, and I have just too many things to finish. So why don't we do this? Why don't we stop right there? We'll pick up and finish this lesson. Please hang on to that outline, and then we'll start the Declaration of Independence next Sunday. How's that? Are you good with hanging on to that? Are you hanging with me? Is this okay, or is it just too much? Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we'll pick up with the Declaration. We'll finish this up. We have just a few slides on this lesson. Hang on to that outline, and then we'll start the Declaration next week. Okay? Thank you guys so much. I hope that this is helpful. Okay? God bless you. We'll take a break, and we'll have service here in just a few minutes.